It's good to be here with you guys. My name's Jordan. If I haven't met you before, I haven't been here very often. I think only once or twice, so it's really great to be with you this evening. I wanted to start our time by telling you a bit of a story. It's a little bit of an insight into my life, and it all started with a puddle. I woke up one morning and we came downstairs from our little unit, and there was a little puddle on the ground near our dining table, and my wife and I, we've got a couple of young kids, and so some liquid on the ground is pretty normal, right? That's pretty standard. You get to a point with a couple of kids where it's weird if there's no liquid on the ground, actually. You're just praying it's a certain kind of liquid and not a whole host of others. But I didn't think much of it, so we got the puddle and we just cleaned it up, went about the day, all good. Next morning, downstairs, puddle, same spot. All right. Kids will be kids, yeah? Clean it up, go back to bed. Next day, same thing, puddle. This time I'm inquisitive. There's no cups around, there's no kids around, there's nothing that could have done it. I'm looking around, where has this puddle come from? What's going on? I look up at the roof. It's kind of got like brown marks around it. I get up on a chair, and I was like, I don't know, do you poke the roof? I'm poking the roof, wet. Like my hand goes into the ceiling a little bit, which I'm no builder, I'm no architect. The ceiling shouldn't do that, right? What had happened was, where our bedroom is on the top floor, we'd had an air conditioner. I do this because it's a really terrible air conditioner. Kind of just feels like someone going all night. Yeah, like that weird goat. That goat's going to creep me out, by the way. Anyway, that had leaked. And so all night, that had been leaking into the floorboards down, stuck in the gap between the floorboards and the ceiling, and just been dripping down, dripping down, dripping down. Well, the thing that I'd thought was just a very simple problem, wipe, 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 I could have done that all the time, wouldn't have mattered. There was a bigger problem going on. Something far more serious than just a puddle. If we hadn't done something about that, there were serious damages, right? There was something far more serious than just a puddle on the ground, and that's often the case, isn't it? There's a presenting issue. You've actually got to dig around to find what's really going on. You'll see it in the medical world all along. You've got symptoms, presenting issues, but you've got to dig down to say, what's the cause of this thing? And the same is true for conflict. You know, there'll be presenting conflicts, things going wrong between people, but it's not until you dig down and figure out, hold on, what's going on between these people? What's going on? You know this is true because no matter how hard we try as people, as humanity together, there's always conflict, isn't there? There has been throughout the ages. We seem to just not be able to get rid of it. There's always conflict. Our society says that we're progressing. We're getting better as time goes on. But how's that going for us? Not that good, is it? You know, a while ago now, World War I. Do you know what they called World War I? The war to end all wars. How'd that go? World War II, not long after. And since then, war, 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 conflict, conflict, conflict. We can't get rid of it. It is all over the place. You can deal with one, you can deal with one presenting issue, but there's just more, there's just more, there's just more. What is going on? What is the cause of this conflict? Our world is marred by this conflict. But surely if there was one place that you'd expect to find peace, no conflict, it would be the church, wouldn't it? God's church. But we know that's not the case, don't we? You can look around. There's all kinds of stories of conflicts within churches. If you're around church any length of time, you'll find that there's conflict here, just like in any other place, even here. And it's this kind of conflict, conflict in the church, that James is speaking about in our passage. Did you catch that as we read it? There's conflict going on. What he wants is peace. He wants peace. This is just before in chapter 3. You know, the wisdom from above is first pure and then peace-loving, gentle. The fruit of righteousness is sown in peace. What does he want? He wants peace. Look at chapter 4, verse 1, though. What do they have instead? What is the source of wars and fights among you? Wars and fights. Those same words, verse 2. You fight and you war. This is strong language, isn't it? He calls it war. He uses, do you see verse 2? You murder. Now, I don't think he's literally talking about murder at this point. You'd think he'd make a bit more of an issue of it if they were actually killing each other, wouldn't you? He's just saying this what's going on between this group of people that he's writing to is so intense, is so full on. It's like you're murdering each other. You're killing each other. What's going on? There's conflict. There's strife. Their church is consumed by it. They're consumed by conflict. There's the presenting issue that James has. There's the puddle on the floor. Now, we could just wipe it up. We could just say, guys, just stop. That'd be good. Thanks. Short letter. Efficient. He doesn't do that, does he? He starts digging. He digs. He's trying to help them to see how they got here. What is the cause of this going on? Why is conflict so common? Why is it? He wants them to see the root cause. There's these symptoms going on, but there's the disease that he wants to cure in them. But that's going to take some digging on his part. What causes people to create conflict? I wonder what you might say. What causes people to create conflict? I think there's at least two very broad options that our world would tell us. The first one is that it's nurture. You know, nurture or nature. The first one is nurture. We want to say that people are basically good, don't we? That if you boil it down, people are actually pretty good. They're a pretty nice guy. They're basically good. But there's this system that just corrupts us. If we could just strip all that away, oh, paradise, utopia. Wouldn't that be good? Because people are good. Let me give you two examples that show this. Old school, new school. Here's the old school. Our world is a romantic world. I don't mean like, ooh la la, you know, Lady and the Tramp spaghetti moment. No, no. We are downstream from the romantic movement from a couple hundred years ago. And what the romantic movement tried to do was show us, man, there is beauty. And it showed that in artwork and beautiful things like that. But it actually tried to show there's beauty within people. That people are basically good. If we could just educate them and move all of the stuff out of the way, we'd actually see, oh, people are really good. They're beautiful. And there was this one guy called Rousseau. Famous, big writer from the romantic time. And I mean, look at that head of hair. That's a good-looking rooster. Look at him. There's this famous story of his that he writes about. He goes out with a bunch of mates and he steals asparagus. Which, look, don't steal anything. But if you're going to steal something, aim higher than asparagus. Nothing. I had my first asparagus this year. My mum, Kathleen, so proud of me, all right? But there's nothing to write home about. But he goes out with his mates and he steals an asparagus. And you know what he does? He starts thinking, man, what happened? What led me to do that? And he comes up with a brilliant idea. He goes, it was everyone else's fault. It wasn't my fault. No. It was everyone else's fault. Here's what he said. He said, I was led into this sin by circumstances rather than by an innate wickedness. Do you catch what he's saying there? It wasn't me being basically bad. No, I'm basically good. It was everyone else that made me do it. It was peer pressure. It was the world around me that made me want to steal an asparagus. Not me. Nurture. There's old school. New school. Have you noticed that every Disney or Marvel villain or anyone like that now has some big backstory? When I was a kid, Cruella de Vil just like skinned puppies and she was bad. Just really nice and simple stuff. I like puppies, she skins puppies, bad. But now there's this whole convoluted backstory that makes you go, oh, actually, she's misunderstood and maybe puppies are bad, actually. You know, like, there's this whole backstory that makes you go, she's actually pretty good. If we could just get all this out, the stuff out around her, we'd see that deep down she's Cruella de Good, you know? We do it all the time because what we want to show is that people are basically good. They're not evil. No. They're good. Why? Why is this nurture argument so compelling? It creates distance between us and the problem. It allows me to say, well, it's not me. It's not me being bad. No. It was just everyone else who's not me. It's not me. It's nurture. Here's where James starts to really rub, where it starts to sting. He won't let us have that. He says, you want to know the problem? It's not nurture. The problem isn't just the things that you do. The problem is you. The problem is you. Look at verse 1 again. What is the source of wars and fights among you? Don't they come from the cravings that are at war within you? See, he's pointing to them at this point. It's the people, but it's not just the things that they're doing. It's not just their actions. It's things inside of them. Did you catch how many times in these couple of verses he talks about things that are going on inside of them? There's cravings within them. There's desires. They covet. That is, they want something that's not theirs. They have wrong motives. They have evil desires. It's in them. It's in them. It's in them. Not external to them. Not other people. In them. What James is at pains to show them is that what is the cause of quarrels? It's your cravings. It's things that you want. It's not external, it's internal. That word for cravings in verse 1, it's the same word that we get the word hedonism from. You know the word hedonism? It's that love of pleasure, that self-indulgent desire. That's what that word's doing. That's what's at work within people, says James. And it's those cravings, the cravings of the things that I want for me, that's what shows itself out in conflict. Cravings to conflict. That's what James is trying to say. That's what you're meant to read the next verse as. You're meant to read it as you desire and do not have, verse 2, so you murder. Cravings, conflict. You covet and you can't obtain, so you fight and war. Cravings to conflict. Because deep down, who is number one in our life? Deep down, it's me. For you, it's you. We are craving our own pleasure, our own desire. And so what happens when you get a lot of people together who all have themselves as their own number one? Conflict. You know, you put a bunch of kids together that all want the same toy. What do you get? Utopia. No, you get an unsanctioned WrestleMania main event. Right? They learn how to suplex out of nowhere. It's conflict. It's chaos. Did anyone teach them that? Now, when you get together, you hurt the other kids. No, you don't have to teach them. It's in them. There's just these cravings, and it shows itself in conflict. What is the cause of it? Friends, it's in us. It's not a few bad eggs out there. It's a common, rotten core in people, in humanity. Let me tell you another story of stolen fruit. Bet you didn't think you'd get more than one of these, did you? All right? This one's from 1,500 years before the last one, from Augustine. He goes out, he steals a pear. I don't know why everyone's stealing all this stuff, but here we are. He goes out, he steals a pear, and he goes back home and he goes, man, what was going on? Why did I do that? I don't even want a pear. You know who he blames? Not the people around him. He just notices in that moment, something just came up inside of him and he just wanted it. Said it was foul and I loved it. I loved my own undoing. I loved my error, not that for which I erred, but for the error itself. He just felt the desire and he realized no one else made me do it. I just wanted it. I just wanted it. Isn't that a moment of honesty? Of just honest reflection? I just wanted it. Plain and simple. That is the picture of James. In the words of Taylor Swift, I'm the problem, it's me. That's James, isn't it? Who's the problem here? It's not people out there, it's you. This is part of the picture that the Bible paints around what sin is. We like to think of sin as just the bad things that we do, maybe just the causing of the conflict itself, but it's more than that. It's things that are going on inside us. It's our desires. It's the things we love. It's when we love things that we ought to hate. It's when we hate things that we ought to love. It's when I desire me as number one. That's sin, not just things I do, things I love. Desires in me, cravings in me, they're sin. That I want my good deep down, left to myself, that I want my good above yours is sin. That I want my good above God's, that's sin. That's our heart. Friends, do not trust your heart. You can't trust it. That's what it's like on its own. And Jeremiah says these words in chapter 17. He says, the heart is more deceitful than anything else. And incurable. Who can know it? James, where do fights and wars and where do they come from? Your heart. That's where they come from. Now, this isn't a very pleasant thing to talk about, is it? It's not very popular. They're not going to make a Disney movie about it because it's depressing, isn't it? We don't like to sit in this. It's uncomfortable. We're looking for an escape from it. But boy, do we need to hear this. We cannot trust our hearts. We can't. And if you thought James was done, he's not even close. He's got a whole nother layer to dig to show us just how uncomfortable it can get, to show us just how wicked we can be. Like a kid who just keeps asking why. James keeps digging, why? Why is there conflict? Our evil desires. Why is there evil desires? Because of the disease that he wants to bring out, the disease that he wants to show them that they have. It's the disease of double-mindedness. The disease of double-mindedness. Look at verse 4 and look what he calls them. Adulteresses. Adulteresses. Now again, he's not talking literally about people who are going and cheating on their spouse or something. He's talking about people who are cheating on God. That's what he's getting at. He's picking up the language of the prophets. The prophets would use this kind of language all the time. They speak about Israel, God's people, as a wife, God as their husband, but the people who go and cheat on him with the other nations, if you remember. You get an example of this in Jeremiah chapter 3. As a woman may betray her lover, so you have betrayed me. That's God speaking, house of Israel. It's worth noting that just using this kind of language will be just much more close to home for some of you than for others, for a bunch of different reasons. It's worth acknowledging that. And you more than anyone will know just how strong this language is. James is not pulling punches. He is desperately shaking these people, trying to get them to see how serious this situation is. It's a picture of these people being aligned with the world, like cheating on God for the world. But what's the outcome of cheating on God with the world? What's the big deal? Look at the next line, verse 4. Don't you know that friendship with the world is hostility towards God? Whoever wants to be the world's friend becomes God's enemy. The problem with our cravings is because we're double-minded. And that causes two kinds of conflict. Yes, it causes conflict amongst other people. But James is showing there's a far bigger conflict to be even worried about. It's conflict with God. Conflict with the Creator. That's what this double-mindedness makes. Why is that the case? Well, look at verse 5. Look how it just talks about God. He talks about him like he's jealous. God is a jealous spouse. You are his, not someone else's. He's given you his son in your place. He's given you his spirit to dwell in you. He's jealous for you. A jealous spouse is a good spouse. Not controlling, domineering jealousy. No. But a spouse that says, no, you're mine. I can't stand the thought of you with someone else. That is the kind of spouse you want. And that is the kind of spouse that God is to his people, says James. A jealous spouse. And yet we, his people, are wooed by the world. It whispers in our ears and we follow. And it's that picture that James summarizes verse 8 as double-mindedness. You double-minded people, quite literally double-souled people, split between two. The people who think that they can have it both ways. The people who think that they can serve two masters. I can serve God and I can serve myself and do all the things that I want for me. Double-souled. The one who thinks they can be married and have a mistress. Double-souled. And so with every fibre of his being, James is trying to shake them and wake them to say, friends, do you not see how serious you find the position you find yourself in? Do you see how serious it is? Wake up. Adulteresses. It's like splitting your soul between two. You can't do it. You pick one. Who you're with shapes the things that you love. And the things that you love will shape the things that you do. I'll say that again. Who you're with will shape the things that you love. And the things that you love will shape the things that you do. That's why we see conflict. That's just the symptom. The problem is double-mindedness. But there's people who try and serve God and serve others, themselves. We see this in all kinds of ways, more broadly than conflict. All kinds of ways. There are those who attend church each and every Sunday, yet Monday comes around and they're very happy to make the dodgy business deal that makes them an extra buck. Is that not double-mindedness? We see it all the time. There are those who come and lead youth group and yet go to the pub and get drunk afterwards. Is that not just double-mindedness? Those who are happy to come and serve and love others on a ministry team and go home and treat their wives terribly. Is that not double-mindedness? James is saying, you don't get that. You pick double-minded, double-soul. But here's where the rubber hits the road. We are all on our own. We all lean towards double-mindedness. We all want it our way. That is the nature of sin. That is the nature of people. We are prone to wander. And so the question to ask yourself as we read this and have the Spirit working in us this evening is, where is your heart? Where is your soul? To whom does it go? If you are feeling uncomfortable in this moment, James is working. The Spirit is working. And can I say, I feel it as much as you might. Because I'm preaching it to me as much as to you. This is in all of us. The Bible isn't a self-help book that makes you feel warm and fuzzy. It's like a mirror that helps you see yourself clearly, finally, that this is what we're actually like, that this is what's going on inside of us. Other people might not be able to see it, but the Scriptures can. God's Spirit can. And at the moment, it feels kind of helpless, doesn't it? Hopeless, bleak. But until you get the diagnosis, you can't get the solution. This is the problem we have. And so what are the solutions? What are the solutions? Well, there's two that James draws our attention to finish our time. Here's the first one. The first one is wisdom. You want to cure this, you need wisdom. James is all about wisdom. Even in our passage picked up before, he's quoting the Proverbs, the great book of wisdom. He wants wisdom, but what is it? What is wisdom? Wisdom is when you see the world rightly, when you see it clearly, when you see things for what they're really like and you act appropriately, when you act in line with reality. So what's he trying to do in this chapter? He's trying to make us wise. Look at verse 9. Be miserable and mourn and weep. Your laughter must change to mourning and your joy to sorrow. He's not saying don't ever laugh. He's not saying don't ever be happy. He's saying if you don't recognize the state you're in, you will not get the help you need. To laugh when things around you are crumbling is foolishness. No, see the world rightly. Be wise. And this is reality. You need to be able to see the world rightly if you're going to get a fix to this. You need wisdom. And so that it's a good thing, isn't it? Chapter 1, verse 5. If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously that wisdom. Wisdom. See things rightly. Second, you need humility. Having seen things rightly, clearly, you react rightly. And so what's the right reaction? Look at verse 6. God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. He makes sure you don't miss it. Look at verse 10. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you. He will lift you up. The Scriptures put us in our place, but they don't leave us there. They drive us to the God who can help. That's what it's doing. And what happens when you humbly draw near to God, when you humbly seek his grace? Look at verse 8. Draw near to God, and what will he do? He will draw near to you. You humble yourselves, he will lift you up. He will accept you. How can I know that he will? We've just heard that he's jealous. How can I know that that's what he'll do? Well, verse 6, just after he's spoken about the jealous God, what does he say? He gives greater grace. As jealous as he is, he gives greater grace. That's how you can be sure he'll have you back. And James wants to make sure that you can have that assurance. What does he call them in verse 11? After having just called them adulteresses, what does he call them? Brothers. Sisters. Sons of God. God will have you back. As long as we continue to turn, he will have us. How can you be sure? Brothers, sisters, he has given his son for you. He has given his son. He has given you his spirit. You think he won't have you back if you turn back? Of course he will. Draw near to him. He will draw near to you. And the beautiful picture is actually that as we make our way towards home, he will work on us and change our desires, cure our double-mindedness slowly. We'll struggle with it, but we ought to see progress. This place, us as this kind of people, should see less conflict than other places, shouldn't we? Shouldn't we? Because God is working for that. And so do you see that progress in yourself? Not other people, on yourself. Do you see that progress? Where are you at with double-mindedness? Do you feel its tug? Or do you see evidence of yourself being friends with the world? For some, as we've gone through this evening, I take it there will be some amongst us who recognize, perhaps for the first time, that you actually just in full-blown adultery against God. That you have flown so far to the world. Others might not be able to tell, but you can and he can. Here with the full force that James gives, friendship with the world is hostility toward God. Repent. Repent. For many, it might not be that there is this full-blown case of adultery, but you can see it step by step. You can see bits. James is warning you as much as anyone else. Watch the steps. Watch them. Can you feel yourself being tugged, your heartstrings being plucked by the world? Be very careful. God will not have it. You cannot have it both ways. Double-souled. And so tonight, what do you need to bring before him? What do you need to bring before him? What has he revealed in your heart that you should take to him? That you need to, by his spirit, change in you? As we wrap up, it's exactly this kind of teaching from the scriptures that leads us to confess our sins with one another. It's one of the great parts of our tradition together. And we do so knowing that God gives greater grace, that he will have us. And so really, what a fitting way to end the big month in together than to confess our sins. Because who are we ultimately? We are the people that God forgave, who needed his forgiveness. We're people who recognize our dependence on God. We're those who come here each week, not with puffed up chests, but on bent knees, asking God afresh to forgive us, acknowledging our weakness and our shortcomings. And so in a moment, Brennan's going to come up and he's going to lead us in confessing our sins with one another. And as he does, can you have these words ringing in your ears? What do you need to bring before God? Consider.